stay where you belong. Madame Michel could have gotten over her sister's death. But can you get over the staging of your own punishment? Above all, there was something else I felt, something new. And as I write it, I am very moved. Proof is I had to put my pen down for 2 minutes so I could cry. This is what I felt. Listening to Madame Michel and seeing her cry, but above all, seeing how it made her feel better to be able to tell her story to me, I understood something. I understood that I was suffering because I couldn't make anyone else around me feel better. I understood that I have a grudge against Papa, Maman, and above all Colombe, because I'm incapable of being useful to them, because there's nothing I can do for them. They are already too far gone in their sickness, and I am too weak. I can see their symptoms clearly, but I'm not skilled to treat them. And so as a result, that makes me as sick as they are. Only I don't see it. Whereas when I was holding Madame Michel's hand, I could feel how sick I was too. And one thing is sure, no matter what, I won't get any better by punishing the people I can't heal. I might have to rethink this business about fire and suicide. Besides, I may as well admit it. I don't really feel like dying. I want to be able to see Madame Michel and Kakuro again, and his unpredictable little great-niece, Yoko, and ask them for help. Of course, I'm not going to show up saying, "Please, help me, I'm a little girl who is suicidal." But I feel like letting other people be good for me. After all, I'm just an unhappy little girl, and even if I'm extremely intelligent, that doesn't change anything, does it? An unhappy little girl who, just when things are at their worst, has been lucky enough to meet some good people. Morally, do I have the right to let this chance go by? Sigh. I don't know. This story is a tragedy, after all. There are some worthy people out there. Be glad, is what I felt like telling myself. But in the end, so much sadness. They end up in the rain. I really don't know what to think. Briefly, I thought I had found my calling. I thought I'd understood that in order to heal, I could heal others. Or at least the other healable people, the ones who can be saved. Instead of moping because I can't save other people. So what does this mean? I'm supposed to become a doctor? Or a writer? It's a bit the same thing, no? And for every Madame Michel, how many Colombes are out there? How many dreary Thibaels?
Chapter 13. In the Pathways of Hell. After Paloma left, I didn't know which way to turn, and sat in my armchair for a long, long time. Then, taking courage in both hands, I dialed Kakuro Ozu's telephone number. Paul Nguyen picked up on the second ring. "Yes, hello, Madame Michel. What can I do for you?" "Well, I would like to speak with Kakuro." "He's not in. Would you like him to call you when he gets back?" "No, no," I said, relieved to be able to go through an intermediary. "Could you tell him that if he hasn't changed his mind, I would be happy to have dinner with him tomorrow evening?" "With pleasure," said Paul Nguyen. I put the phone down and flopped back into the armchair, and for the past hour have let myself be carried away by confused but pleasant thoughts. "It doesn't smell too good in your place now, does it?" says a soft male voice at my back. "Isn't there anyone who can come to fix it?" He opened the door so quietly that I didn't hear him. A nice-looking young man with rather disheveled brown hair and a brand-new jean jacket and the large eyes of an amiable cocker spaniel. "Jean? Jean Ardant?" I ask, scarcely believing my eyes. "Yep," he replies, leaning his head to one side the way he used to. But that is all that lingers of the human wreck. that ravaged young soul in the emaciated body he used to be. Jean Artan, once so very close to the abyss, has visibly opted for rebirth. You look great, I say, with my broadest smile, which he returns in kind. Well, good morning, Madame Michel. It is a pleasure to see you. It suits you, he adds, pointing to my hairstyle. Thank you. What brings you here? Would you like a cup of tea? He begins, with a hint of his old hesitancy. Yep, I'd love one. I prepare the tea and he sits down on a chair and looks at Leo, eyes wide in astonishment. Was this cat of yours always so fat? He inquires, not meaning it in a nasty way. Yes, he's not terribly athletic. It's not him that smells so bad, is it? With an apologetic expression, he sniffs the cat. No, there's something wrong with the plumbing. You must find it strange that I've just shown up here like this, especially as we never really talked much. I wasn't very talkative in those days. Well, in my father's days. I'm happy to see you, and above all, to see that you seem to be doing well, I say with sincerity. Yeah, I had a close shave. We take little sips of scorching tea simultaneously. I'm cured now. Well, I'd like to think I'm cured. If you can ever be cured, but I'm keeping off drugs. I've met a nice girl. Well, a fantastic girl, rather, I must say. His eyes open wide and he sniffles slightly as he looks at me. And I've found a little job I like. What are you doing? I'm working at a ship's chandler's. Parts for boats? Yep. And it's a fun job. It's kind of like being on vacation there. Guys come in and tell me about their boat, the seas they're about to sail, the seas where they've been. I like that. And then I'm happy to have a job, you know? What do you actually do at your job? I'm sort of the factotum, stock man and messenger boy. But I'm learning as I go along. So now, from time to time, they give me more interesting things to do, like repair sails or shrouds or put together the provision inventory. Just listen to the poetry of the language. Provisioning a sailboat. Providing what is needed with a vision of the future. To those who have not understood that the enchantment of language comes from such nuances, I shall address the following prayer. Beware of commas. And you too look like you're doing well, he says with a kindly gaze. Really? Well, there have been a few changes that have been good for me. You know, I didn't come back here to see the apartment or the people here. I'm not even sure they'd recognize me. I even brought my ID card, just in case you yourself didn't recognize me. No, I came because there's something I can't remember. Something that helped me a lot already when I was sick, and then afterwards when I was getting better. And you think I can help? Yes, because you were the one who told me the name of those flowers one day. In the flower bed over there. He points toward the far side of the courtyard. There are some pretty little red and white flowers. You planted them there, didn't you? And one day I asked you what they were, but I wasn't able to remember the name. And yet I used to think about those flowers all the time. I don't know why. They're nice to look at. And when I was so bad off, I would think about those flowers, and it did me good. So I was in the neighborhood just now, and I thought, I'm going to ask Madame Michel, maybe she can tell me. Slightly embarrassed, he waits for my reaction. You must seem weird, no? I hope I'm not scaring you with this flower business. No, not at all. If only I'd known the good they were doing you, I'd have planted them all over the place. He laughs like a delighted child. Oh, Madame Michel, you know, it practically saved my life. That in itself is a miracle. So can you tell me what they're called? Yes, my angel, I can. Along the pathways of hell, breathless, one's heart in one's mouth, a faint glow. They are camellias. Yes, I say. They are camellias. He stares at me, wide-eyed. A tear slips across his waif-like cheek. Camellias, he says, lost in a memory that is his alone. Camellias, yes. He repeats the word, looking at me again. That's it. Camellias. I feel a tear on my own cheek. I take his hand. Jean, you cannot imagine how happy I am that you came by here today. Really? He looks astonished. But why? Why? Because a camellia can change fate. Chapter 14. From Passageway to Pathway. What is this war we are waging when defeat is so certain? Day after day, already wearied by the constant onslaught, we face our terror of the everyday. The endless passageway that, in the end, because we have spent so much time walking to and fro between its walls, will become a destiny. Yes, my angel, that is our everyday existence, dreary, empty, and mired deep in troubles. The pathways of hell are hardly foreign. We shall end up there one day if we tarry too long. From a passageway to a pathway, it is an easy fall, without shock or surprises. Every day we are reacquainted with the sadness of the passageway, and step by step, we clear the path toward our mournful doom. Did he see the pathways? How is one reborn after a fall? What new pupils restores sight to scorched eyes? Where does war begin? Where does combat end? Thus, a camellia. Chapter 15. His shoulders soaked with sweat. At 8 o'clock, Paul Nguyen comes to my loge, his arms loaded with packages. Monsieur Ozu has not come back yet. There's a problem at the embassy regarding his visa, so he asked me to bring all of this to you, he says, with a lovely smile. He places the packages on the table and hands me a little card. Thank you, I say. Would you like something to drink? Thank you, but I still have a great deal to do. I'll take a rain check for your invitation for another time. He smiles again, and there is something warm and happy about his expression. This does me untold good. Alone in the kitchen, I sit by the packages and open the envelope. Suddenly, on his shoulders, soaked with sweat, he felt a pleasant and airy sensation that he could not initially explain. But during the pause, he noticed that a huge black cloud, drifting low in the sky, had just fallen to earth. Please accept these few gifts with simplicity. Kakuro. The summer rain on Levin's shoulders as he is scything. I raise my hand to my chest, touched in a way I have never been. One by one, I open the packages. A wraparound dress in a pearly gray silk, with a high round neck and a black satin strap to hold it closed. The purple silk scarf, light and bracing like the wind. Low-heeled pumps, in leather of so fine and soft a grain that I lift one to my cheek. I look at the dress, the scarf, the pumps. Outside, Leo is scratching at the door, meowing to come in. I begin to cry, quietly, slowly, a trembling camellia in my breast. Chapter 16. Something must come to an end. The next morning at 10, there is a knock on the glass. A sort of immense beanpole, dressed all in black, with a navy blue knit beanie on his head and military boots that must have seen duty in Vietnam. It happens to be Colombe's boyfriend, a world specialist in the use of the ellipsis in stock polite formulas. I'm looking for Colombe, says Thibert. Appreciate, if you will, how ridiculous the sentence is. I am looking for Juliette, said Romeo. I am looking for Colombe, thus spake Thibert, who fears nothing save shampoo. This becomes apparent when he removes his head covering, which he does not because he is courteous, but because he is very warm. It is May, by Jove. Paloma said she was here, he adds, and concludes. Shit, what the fuck? Paloma, you are having a good time. I send him promptly on his way and become immersed in strange thoughts. Thibert. Such an illustrious name for such a pathetic demeanor. I think of Colombe Josse's prose, the silent corridors of Le Solchoir, and my mind finds itself in Rome. Tiberius. The memory of Jean Artin's face suddenly takes me unaware. Then I see his father, and that outdated Lavalier of his, so ridiculous. So many quests, all these different worlds. Can we all be so similar yet live in such disparate worlds? Is it possible that we are all sharing the same frenetic agitation, even though we have not sprung from the same earth or the same blood and do not share the same ambition? Tiberius. I feel weary, to be honest. Weary of all these rich people. All these poor people. Weary of the whole farce. Leo jumps from his armchair and comes to rub up against my leg. This cat, made obese only by virtue of charity, is also a generous soul who can feel the irresolution of my own. Weary. Yes, I am weary. Something must come to end. Something must begin. Chapter 17. The Travails of Dressing Up. At 8 o'clock, I am ready. The dress and the shoes fit perfectly. 12 and 7. The shawl is Roman, 2 feet wide and 6 feet long. I dried my hair, which I had washed 3 times with the babyless 1600-watt hairdryer, and combed it 2 times in all directions. The results are astonishing. I sat down 4 times and got up again 4 times, which explains why at present I am standing up and do not know what to do. Sit down, perhaps. From their box hidden behind the sheets at the back of the wardrobe, I have brought out 2 earrings, inherited from my mother-in-law, the monstrous Yvette, antique silver, dangling, with 2 pear-shaped garnets. I made 6 attempts before I managed to clip them properly to my earlobes, and now must live with the sensation of having 2 pot-bellied cats hanging from my distended lobes. 54 years without jewelry do not prepare one for the travails of dressing up. I smeared my lips with 1 layer of deep carmine lipstick that I had bought 20 years ago for a cousin's wedding. The longevity of such a useless item, when valiant lives are lost every day, will never cease to confound me. I belong to the 8% of the world population who calm their apprehension by drowning it in numbers. Kakuro Ozu knocks 2 times at my door. I open. He is very handsome. He is wearing a charcoal gray suit, consisting of straight trousers and a jacket with a mandarin collar and ornamental frog fastenings in matching tones. On his feet are soft leather loafers that look like luxurious slippers. The effect is very Eurasian. Oh, you look magnificent, he says. Oh, thank you, I say, touched. And you look very handsome yourself. Happy birthday. He smiles, and after I have carefully closed the door behind me, before Leo can manage to slip past, Kakuro extends an arm out for me to place my slightly trembling hand on his elbow. Let us hope no one will see us, begs a voice inside, still resisting, the voice of René the clandestine. No matter that I have tossed a goodly number of my fears onto the bonfire, I am not yet ready to serve as copy for the Grenelle gossip columns. Someone's in for quite a surprise. The front door, where we are headed, opens before we have even reached it. It is Yacinthe Rosen, and Anne-Hélène Maurice. A pox upon it, what am I to do? We are already upon them. Good evening, dear ladies, twitters Kakuro, pulling me firmly over to his left, passing them quickly. Good evening, dear friends, we are late. Lovely to see you. We are in a terrible rush. Oh, good evening, Monsieur Ozu, they simper, enthralled, turning in unison to follow us with their gaze. Good evening, madame, they say to me, smiling with all their teeth. I have never seen so many teeth all at once.
Until we next have the pleasure, whispers Anne-Hélène Maurice,
staring intently as we make our way through the door. To be sure, chirps Kakuro, pushing the door with his heel. Heavens, he says, if we had stopped, we would have been there for an hour.
They didn't recognize me, I say.
I come to a halt in the middle of the sidewalk, completely flabbergasted.
They didn't recognize me, I repeat.
He stops in turn, my hand still on his arm. It is because they have never seen you, he says. I would recognize you anywhere. Chapter 18. Flowing Water. All it takes is one experience of being blind in broad daylight and able to see in pitch dark to wonder what sight is all about. Why do we see? While climbing into the taxi that Kakuro had ordered, I think about Hyacinthe Rosen and Anne-Hélène Maurice, who noticed nothing of me beyond what they could see, on Monsieur Ozu's arm, in a world of hierarchy. And I am struck with incredible force by this proof that sight is like a hand that tries to seize flowing water. Yes, our eyes may perceive, yet they do not observe. They may believe, yet they do not question. They may receive, yet they do not search. They are emptied of desire, with neither hunger nor passion. And as the taxi glides through the early twilight, I become thoughtful. I think of Jean Artin, his scorched pupils illuminated with camellias. I think of Pierre Artin, his sharp eye with the blindness of a beggar. I think of these avid ladies, their greedy gaze unseeing, futile. I think of Jejene, his sunken eyes, with neither life nor force, seeing nothing beyond his own fall. I think of Lucien, ill-suited to vision, because obscurity often, in the end, proves too strong. I think even of Neptune, whose eyes are a doggy nose that does not lie. And I wonder how well I myself can see. Chapter 19. They Shimmer. Have you seen Black Rain? Because if you have not seen Black Rain, or in a pinch Blade Runner, it will surely be difficult for you to understand why, when we go into the restaurant, I have the sensation that I am on the set of a Ridley Scott film. There is that scene in Blade Runner in the Snake Woman's bar where Deckard calls Rachel from a mural video phone. There is also the call girls bar in Black Rain with Kate Capshaw's blonde hair and naked back, and those shots lit as if through a stained glass window with a brilliance of cathedrals surrounded by all the penumbra of hell. I like the light in here, I say to Kakuro as we sit down. They have led us to a quiet little booth, filled with a solar light circled with shimmering shadows. How can shadows shimmer? They shimmer. That's all there is to it. Have you seen Black Rain? Asks Kakuro. I should scarcely have believed that between two people there could exist such a congruity of tastes and thought patterns. Yes, I say. At least a dozen times. The atmosphere is brilliant, bubbly, racy, plush, crystalline, magnificent. We are going to have an orgy of sushi, says Kakuro, unfolding his napkin with panache. I hope you don't mind. I've already ordered. I want you to discover what I consider to be the very best Paris has to offer in the way of Japanese cuisine. I don't mind at all, I say, my eyes open wide, because the waiters have placed before us several bottles of sake and myriad little bowls filled with clusters of tiny vegetables that have clearly been marinated in something bound to be very tasty. And we begin. I fish for a piece of marinated cucumber, only nominally either marinated or cucumber, as it has been transformed into something that is delicious beyond description. With his auburn wooden chopsticks, Kakuro delicately lifts a fragment of mandarin orange, tomato, mango, and skillfully causes it to vanish. I immediately dip into the same bowl. It is a sweet carrot for a gourmet god. Happy birthday, then. I raise my cup of sake. Thank you. Thank you very much. We touch our cups together. Is this octopus? I ask, for I have just found a crinkly little tentacle in a bowl of saffron yellow sauce. The waiter brings two thick little wooden trays without edges, covered with pieces of raw fish. Sashimi, says Kakuro. There is some octopus here, too. I am lost in contemplation of the masterpiece. The visual beauty of it is enough to take your breath away. I squeeze a little chunk of white and gray flesh between my clumsy chopsticks. That's place, elucidates Kakuro obligingly, and, determined to find ecstasy, raise it to my mouth. Why do we go in search of eternity in the ether of invisible essences? This little whitish chunk is a far more tangible morsel thereof. Rene, says Kakuro, I am very happy to be celebrating my birthday in your company. But I also have a more pressing reason to have dinner with you. Although we have only known each other for 3 weeks or so, I am becoming familiar with Kakuro's reasons. France or England, Vermeer or Caravaggio, War and Peace, or our beloved Anna. I wolf down another featherlight sashimi, tuna, of a respectable dimension, which might, I concede, have preferred to be divided in two. I did invite you to celebrate my birthday with me, but in the meantime, someone has given me some very important information, so I have something crucial to tell you. The piece of tuna has been absorbing all my attention and does not leave me prepared for what is about to follow. You are not your sister, says Kakuro, looking me straight in the eyes. Chapter 20. Gagos Tribes. Ladies, if on an evening you are invited by a rich and agreeable gentleman to dinner at a luxurious restaurant, be sure you behave at all moments with equal elegance. If you happen to be surprised or annoyed or disconcerted in any way, you must preserve the same refinement in your impassivity, and should a turn of phrase astonish you, you must react with the distinction appropriate to such vexations. Instead, because I am a country bumpkin who gulps down sashimi as if they were spuds, I begin to hiccup spasmodically, and, aghast at the prospect that the fragment of eternity might well have become lodged in my throat, I endeavor with all the distinction of a gorilla to spit it out forthwith. All around us silence has fallen. After many eructations and a last and very melodramatic spasm, I finally succeed in dislodging the guilty morsel, and grabbing hold of my napkin, I lodge it there in extremis. Should I say it again? Asks Kakuro, who, dash it, seems to be enjoying himself. Cough is a traditional response in the fraternal prayer ritual of the Gagos tribes. My conversation is evolving brilliantly. Then, with a show of class that clearly seeks to best all my efforts thus far.
What?
I'll say it again to make myself perfectly clear, says Kakuro, with the sort of infinite patience one exercises with children, or rather the simple-minded. Renee, you are not your sister. And as I go on, sitting there like a moron, staring at him, I'll repeat it one last time, in the hopes that this time you won't choke on a piece of sushi that, I might mention, costs 30 euros apiece and normally require a bit more care in their consumption. You are not your sister. We can be friends. We can be anything we want to be. Chapter 21. All those cups of tea. Toom, 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 toom. Look, if you had one shot, one opportunity to seize everything you ever wanted, one moment, would you capture it or just let it slip? That's Eminem. I confess that in my capacity as prophet of the contemporary elite, I do on occasion listen to him when I can no longer ignore the fact that Dido has perished. But above all, I am greatly confused. The proof of it? Here. Remember me. Remember me. But I forget my fate. 30 euros apiece. Would you capture it or just let it slip? That is what is going around inside my head, and it needs no commentary. The strange way that a tune can get stuck in one's mind will always amaze me. Not to mention a certain Confutatis, patron saint of small-bladdered concierge, and it is merely with passing, though sincere, interest that I notice that this time it is the medley that has prevailed. And then I burst into tears. At the Brasserie des Amis, in a dreary banlieue like Puteau, a patron who almost chokes, barely comes out of it alive, and then bursts into tears with her face in her napkin, would be priceless entertainment. But here, in this solar temple, where sashimi are sold by the piece, my excesses have the opposite effect. A wave of silent reproach has enclosed me, and here am I, sobbing, my nose running, obliged to find refuge in an already seriously encumbered napkin in order to wipe away the marks of my emotion and attempt to hide a behavior that public opinion reproves, which only causes me to sob all the harder. Paloma has betrayed me. So, impelled by my sobs, it unravels in my bosom. This life spent in the clandestinity of a solitary mind, all these reclusive readings, all these winters of illness, all that November rain on Lisette's lovely face, all the camellias restored from hell and come to rest on the moss of the temple, all these cups of tea in the warmth of friendship, all these words spelling wonder from the lips of my schoolteacher, these so wobby still lifes, these everlasting essences luminous with their own singular light, and these summer rains bursting in the delight of pleasure, snowflakes dancing the melopoeia of the heart. And then, in the jewel case of old Japan, the pure face of Paloma, I am weeping, weeping uncontrollably, thick, round, lustrous tears of happiness, while all around us the world is fading, leaving nothing to the senses beyond the gaze of this man in whose company I feel like somebody, and who has taken me gently by the hand and is smiling at me with all the warmth in the world. Thank you, I manage to whisper. We can be friends, he says. We can be anything we want to be. Remember me, remember me. And envy my fate. Chapter 22. Meadow Grass. I know now what you have to experience before you die. Let me tell you. What you have to experience before you die is a driving rain transformed into light. I did not sleep all night. After, and in spite of, my infinitely gracious outpourings, dinner was marvelous, smooth, full of complicity, with long, sweet silences. When Kakuro walked me back to my door, he kissed my hand for a long time, and that is how we said goodbye. Without a word, with a simple, electric smile. I did not sleep all night, and you know why? Of course you do. Of course everyone must know that along with everything else, that is, a seismic tremor suddenly turning a thawed-out life upside down, something more must be jogging through my little 50-something schoolgirl's head. And what if I say it out loud? We can be anything we want to be. At 7 o'clock I get up, as if propelled by a spring, catapulting my indignant cat to the other end of the bed. I'm hungry. I am literally hungry. A colossal slice of bread, staggering under the weight of butter and cherry plum jam, only serves to sharpen my gargantuan appetite. And I am figuratively hungry. I am in a state of frenzied impatience to find out what will happen. I roam through my kitchen like a wild animal in a cage. I scold my cat, who pays not the slightest attention. I indulge in a second round of bread, butter, jam. Pace up and down, putting things away that do not need putting away. And prepare myself for a third round of bakery consumption. And then, all of a sudden, at 8 o'clock, I calm down. For no particular reason, and in the most surprising way, a great feeling of serenity trickles over me. What is happening? A mutation. I can see no other possible explanation. Some people find themselves growing gills. In my case, 'tis wisdom. I flop into a chair, and life goes on its way. A way which, incidentally, is hardly cause for exaltation. It occurs to me that I am still a concierge, and that at 9 o'clock I have to go to the Rue de Bac to buy some brass cleaner. At 9 o'clock is a whimsical addition, let's just say at some point during the morning. But yesterday, as I was planning today's chores, I thought to myself, I'll go around 9. So I take my shopping bag and my purse and head out into the wide world in quest of a substance that will cause the ornaments in rich people's houses to shine. It is a marvelous spring day outside. From a distance I can see Zhizhen extricating himself from his cardboard. For his sake, I am pleased there is fine weather ahead. I think briefly of how fond the old tramp was of that arrogant grand master of gastronomy, and it brings a smile to my lips. For those who are content, class struggle suddenly seems less important, I muse, surprised that my rebellious consciousness has yielded in this way. And then it happens. Zhizhen staggers. I am only a dozen steps away from him. I frown, concerned. He is staggering uncontrollably, as if he were on the slippery deck of a pitching ship. And I can see his face, his lost look. What is going on, I wonder, out loud, and hurry toward the pauper. Ordinarily, Zhizhen would not be drunk at this time of day. And besides, he holds his liquor the way a cow does its meadow grass. Woe of woes, the street is almost deserted. I am the only person who has noticed the poor man teetering on his feet. He takes a few wobbly steps toward the curb, stops, and then, when I am no more than 6 feet away, suddenly breaks into a run, as if he were being pursued by a million demons. And this is what happens next. What happens next, like everyone, I wish it would never happen. Chapter 23. My Camellias. I die. I know with a certainty that is close to divination that I am dying, that I'm about to expire on the Rue de Bac, on a fine spring morning, because a tramp named Zhizhen, suddenly overcome with St. Vitus dance, wandered onto the deserted street without a care for either man or God. But that street was not so deserted after all. I ran after Zhizhen, leaving my shopping bag and purse behind me, and then I was struck. It was only as I was falling, after a stunned moment of utter incomprehension, before the pain crushed me, that I saw what had struck me. And now I am lying on my back, with an unrestricted view, onto the side of a dry cleaner's van. It had tried to avoid me and skidded off to the left, but too late. I bore the full brunt of its left front fender. The blue logo on the side of the little white vehicle says, Malavoie Cleaners. If I could, I would laugh. The paths of God are all too explicit for those who pride themselves on their ability to decipher them. I think of Manuela, who will feel remorse until the end of her days over this death by dry cleaning. Can it be anything other than a punishment for the double theft of which, through her great fault, I was guilty? Now the pain is overwhelming me. The pain in my body, radiating, sweeping through me, succeeding brilliantly in being nowhere in particular and everywhere at once. Wherever my body has a nerve to feel, but also the pain in my soul, because I have thought of Manuela, whom I will leave behind, alone, and never see again, and this sends a stabbing pain straight to my heart. They say that in the moment of your death, you see your entire life, but passing before my wide-open eyes, they can no longer make out either the van or its driver, the young woman who had handed me the plum-colored linen dress, and who is now crying and wailing without a care for propriety, nor do they see the passers-by who ran over after the accident and who are all talking to me non-stop with none of it making any sense. Passing before my wide-open eyes that can no longer see the outside world is a procession of beloved faces, and as each one goes by, my thoughts are wrenching. With respect to faces, the first one is a little muzzle. Yes, my first thoughts go to my cat. Not that he is the most important one of all, but before the real torment and the real farewells begin, I need to be reassured regarding the fate of my four-footed companion. I smile to myself, thinking about the big fat windbag who has been my partner through these years of widowhood and solitude. And I smile sadly, tenderly, because, seen from death, our close relations with our domestic animals no longer seem to be something minor to be taken for granted, given their everyday nature. 10 years of a lifetime have crystallized in Leo, and I take the measure of how the ridiculous, superfluous cats who wander through our lives with all the placidity and indifference of an imbecile are, in fact, the guardians of life's good and joyful moments, and of its happy web, even beneath the canopy of misfortune. Farewell, Leo, I say to myself. Saying farewell to a life I did not think I would be so reluctant to lose. I entrust the fate of my cat to Olympe Saint-Denis, with the deep relief of knowing with the utmost certainty that she will take good care of him. Now I can confront the others. Manuela. Manuela, my friend. Now that I am about to die, I shall say to you at last. Do you recall all our cups of tea in the silk of friendship? 10 years of tea and saying vous to each other. And at the end of it, a warmth in my breast and a hopeless gratitude toward someone or something. Life, perhaps, for having graced me with your friendship. Do you know that it is in your company that I have had my finest thoughts? Must I die to realize this at last? All those hours drinking tea in the refined company of a great lady who has neither wealth nor palaces, only the bare skin in which she was born. Without those hours, I would have remained a mere concierge. But instead, it was contagious, because the aristocracy of the heart is a contagious emotion. So you made of me a woman who could be a friend. How easy would it have been to transform the thirst of a poor woman like me into the pleasure of art? To conceive a passion for blue china, for rustling foliage, for languid camellias, and all the centuries' eternal jewels, all these precious pearls, in the endless movement of the river, if you had not, week after week, offered your heart and made with me the sacrifice to the sacred ritual of tea. How I miss you already. This morning I understand what it means to die. When we disappear, it is others who die for us. For here I am, lying on the cold pavement, and it is not the dying I care about. It has no more meaning this morning than it did yesterday. But never again will I see those I love. And if that is what dying is about, then it really is the tragedy they say it is. Manuela, my sister, may fate keep me from being for you what you were for me, a safeguard against unhappiness, a rampart against banality. Carry on with your life, and think of me with joy. But in my heart, the idea that I shall never see you again is infinite torture. There you are, Lucien, on a yellowed photograph, as if on a medallion, the way I see you in memory. You are smiling, whistling. Was it like this for you, too? The feeling that it was my death and not your own? The end of our gazes, long before the terror of going into the darkness? What remains of a life, exactly, when those who spent it together will now have both been dead for so long? Today a strange feeling has taken hold, that I am betraying you by dying. I am truly causing you to die. Is it not enough in this ordeal to feel that others are becoming distant? Must we also put to death those who were still alive only through us? And yet you are smiling and whistling, and I too am smiling. Lucien, I did love you well, after all, and for that reason, perhaps, I deserve to rest. We'll sleep in peace in the little cemetery in our village. You can hear the river in the distance. They fish for shad and gudgeon there. Children come to play, shrieking their heads off. In the evening at sunset, you can hear the Angelus. And you, Kakuro, dear Kakuro, who made me believe in the possibility of a camellia. Only fleetingly do I think of you today. A few weeks do not provide the key. I hardly know you beyond the person you were for me. A heavenly benefactor, a miraculous balm against all the certainties of fate. How could it be otherwise? Who knows? I cannot help but feel my heart ache over that uncertainty. And what if? And what if you had made me laugh again, and talk, and cry, washing away all those years of feeling tainted by sin, restoring to Lisette her lost honor through the complicity of an improbable love? What a shame. You are fading into the night, and at this moment when I know I shall never see you again, I must give up all hope of ever knowing what fate's answer might have been. Is this what dying is about? Is it so pitiful? And how much time is left? An eternity, if I still do not know. Paloma, my child, now it is your turn. You are last. Paloma, my child. I did not have any children, because it did not happen that way. Did I suffer because of it? No, but if I had had a daughter, it is you she would have been. And with all my strength, I implore that your life be worthy of all that you promise. And then, an illumination. A true illumination.
I see your lovely face, grave and pure. The pink frames of your eyeglasses, and the way you have of fiddling with the hem of your sweater, of looking me straight in the eye and stroking the cat as if he could speak. And I start to cry. To cry from the joy inside. What do these onlookers see as they bend over my broken body? I do not know. But inside me, the sun.
How to measure a life's worth.
The important thing, said Paloma one day, is not the fact of dying. It is what you are doing in the moment of your death. What was I doing in the moment of my death, I wonder? With an answer ready in the warmth of my heart. What was I doing? I had met another and was prepared to love. After 54 years of emotional and psychological wilderness, hardly touched by the tenderness of someone like Lucien, who was little more than a resigned shadow of myself, after 54 years of clandestinity and silent victories inside the padded walls of a lonely mind, after 54 years of venting my futile frustrations upon a world and a caste I despised, after these 54 years of nothingness, where I met no one and was never with another, Manuela, always, but also Kakuro, and Paloma, my kindred soul, my camellias, I would gladly share a last cup of tea with you. And then a jolly cocker spaniel, his ears and tongue dangling, runs across my line of vision. How ridiculous. But I would still like to laugh. Farewell, Neptune. You are a ninny of a dog. But I suppose death makes us run off the rails somewhat. Perhaps it is you I shall think of last. And if there is any meaning behind it, it is beyond my grasp. Ah, no, wait. One last image. How odd. I can't see any more faces. It will be summer soon. It's 7 o'clock. At the village church, the bells are ringing. I see my father, his back bent, his arms straining. He's turning the June earth. The sun is setting. My father straightens, wipes his brow with the back of his sleeve, comes away home. End of the day's toil. It'll soon be 9 o'clock. Peacefully, I die.
One last profound thought. What to do faced with never, but look for always in a few stolen strains? This morning, Madame Michel died. She was knocked over by a dry cleaner's van near the Rue de Bac. I cannot believe I am writing these words. It was Kakuro who brought me the news. Apparently Paul, his secretary, was walking up the street at the time. He saw the accident from a distance, but when he got there, it was too late. She wanted to help Jejen, the tramp who's on the corner of the Rue de Bac and who was drunk as a skunk. She ran after him, but she didn't see the van. Apparently, they had to take the driver to the hospital. She was a nervous wreck. Kakuro came and rang our bell at around 11. He asked to see me, and he took my hand and said, "There is no way I can spare you this pain, Paloma, so I'll just tell it to you the way it happened. René had an accident at around 9 o'clock. A very serious accident. She's dead." He was crying. He squeezed my hand very hard. "Dear God, who is René?" asked my mother, alarmed. "Madame Michel," answered Kakuro. "Oh," she went, relieved. He turned away from her, disgusted. "Paloma, I have to take care of a lot of not very cheerful things, but we'll see each other later on, okay? He said. I nodded and squeezed his hand very hard, too. We acknowledged each other in the Japanese manner. A quick little bow. We understand each other. We're both hurting. Hurting. When he had gone, the only thing I wanted was to avoid Maman. She opened her mouth, but I made a gesture with my hand, my palm raised toward her as if to say, "Don't even try." She gulped but didn't come near. She let me go off to my room. When I got there, I rolled myself into a ball on my bed. After half an hour, Maman knocked gently on the door. "No," I said. She didn't insist. 10 hours have gone by since then. A lot of things have happened in the building, too. I'll summarize. Olympe Saint-Nice rushed to the loge when she heard the news. A locksmith came to open the door, so she could take Leo to her place. I think that Madame Michel, that Clunet, I think that's what she would have wanted. I was relieved. Madame de Brouilly took charge of the operations, under Kakuro's supreme command. It's odd how that old bag seemed almost nice. She said to Maman, her new friend, "She was here for 27 years. We're going to miss her." Right away, she organized a collection for the flowers and said she would contact Lene's family members. Are there any? I don't know, but Madame de Brouilly will find out. The hardest was Madame Lopez. Once again, it was Madame de Brouilly who told her when she came at 10 to do the cleaning. Apparently, she stood there for a few seconds, not understanding, her hand on her mouth. And then she collapsed. When she revived, a quarter of an hour later, she just murmured, "Forgive me. Oh, forgive me." And then she put on her scarf and went home. It's heartbreaking. What about me? What do I feel? I may be chattering away about the little events at 7 Clos de Glenelle, but I'm not very brave. I'm afraid to go into myself and see what's going on in there. And I'm ashamed. I think I wanted to die and make Colombe and Maman and Papa suffer because I hadn't ever really suffered. Or rather, I was suffering, but it didn't hurt, and as a result, all my little plans were just the luxury of some problem-free teenager. Poor little rich girl rationalizing things, wanting to draw attention to herself. But this time, for the very first time, it hurt. It really hurt. Like a fist in my stomach. I couldn't breathe. My heart aching fit to burst, my tummy crushed, an unbearable physical pain. I wondered if I'd ever get over the pain of it. It hurt so much I wanted to scream, but I didn't scream. What I feel now is that the pain is still there, but it isn't keeping me from walking or talking. It's a feeling of complete helplessness and absurdity. So that's what it's like? All of a sudden, all possibility just vanishes? A life full of projects, discussions just started, desires not even fulfilled. It all vanishes in a second, and there's nothing left to do, and there's no going back? For the first time in my life, I understood the meaning of the word never. And it's really awful. You say the word 100 times a day, but you don't really know what you're saying until you're faced with a real never again. Ultimately, you always have the illusion that you're in control of what's happening. Nothing seems definitive. I may have been telling myself all these weeks that I was going to commit suicide, but did I really believe it? Did my decision really make me understand the meaning of the word never? Not at all. It made me understand that it's in my power to decide. And I think that even a few seconds before dying, never again would still just be empty words. But when someone that you love dies, well, I can tell you that you really feel what it means. And it really, really hurts. It's like fireworks suddenly burning out in the sky and everything going black. I feel alone and sick, and my heart aches, and every movement seems to require a colossal effort. And then, something happened. It's hard to believe it's such a sad day. At around 5, I went down to Madame Michel's loge. I mean, Renée's loge, with Kakuro because he wanted to get some of her clothes to take them to the hospital morgue. He rang at our door and asked Maman if he could speak to me. But I had guessed it would be him. I was already there. Of course I wanted to go with him. We took the elevator down, not speaking. He looked very tired, more tired than sad, and I thought, that is what suffering looks like on a wise face. It's not apparent. It just leaves traces that make you look very, very tired. Do I look tired too? In any event, Kakuro and I went down to the loge. But while we were crossing the courtyard, we stopped short, both of us at the same time. Someone had begun to play the piano, and we could hear very clearly what they were playing. It was Satie, I think. Well, I'm not sure. But anyway, it was classical. I don't really have any profound thoughts on the matter. Besides, how can you have a profound thought when your kindred soul is lying in a hospital refrigerator? But I know we stopped short, both of us, and took a deep breath and let the sun warm our faces while we listened to the music drifting down from above.
I think Renée would have liked this moment, said Kakuro.
And we stayed there a few more minutes, listening to the music. I agreed with him. But why? Thinking back on it this evening, with my heart and my stomach all like jelly, I have finally concluded, maybe that's what life is about. There's a lot of despair, but also the odd moment of beauty, where time is no longer the same. It's as if those strains of music created a sort of interlude in time, something suspended, an elsewhere that had come to us, an always within never. Yes, that's it. An always within never. Don't worry, Renée. I won't commit suicide, and I won't burn a thing. Because from now on, for you, I'll be searching for those moments of always within never. Beauty in this world.
This has been a Highbridge Audio presentation.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.